everybody. My name is Uncle Jim. I'm an alcoholic still. Tonight we have the privilege of meeting an old friend, and we're actually a pretty young friend. But she's a sponsor. She's a sponsee. She's been with us since March of 2011. Currently, she resides up in the Sacramento, beautiful Sacramento area, California. And if we could give a warm Valley group welcome, welcoming her back, of course, because she's a little ways away now, but to live from Sacramento, California.
Hi, everyone. I'm Blythe. I'm an alcoholic and from Sacramento. It feels so weird to say that, you know, spending 10 years in Visalia and now, you know, I live somewhere else. It's so crazy. It's crazy where life takes you, right? When you get sober and you, like, work a program and you, you know, get healthy again. As Jim mentioned, I celebrated 10 years of sobriety in March. So March 6, 2011, and I just can't even believe that that is possible. When I came in, I didn't want to be sober. I didn't think I would stay sober, and I didn't know that it was a way of life. You know, I thought it was just going to be a quick dry thing and learn how to drink better, and that is definitely not what is what happened. But I think before I get started, I'm going to read this. I found this pamphlet in my book. I had cut it out. I think it's from the Armed Services pamphlet, which is crazy because I was never in the Armed Services. And I think I just picked it up when I was new, and I read it, and it really helped me identify as an alcoholic because I was really struggling with, you know, listening to people's stories and being like, well, I never got a DUI. Did I drive drunk? Yes, absolutely. I just didn't get caught. You know, or people saying that they were in jail, you know, for shoplifting. Did I break and enter and steal people's things? Yes, I just didn't get caught. You know, but I was sitting there thinking like, well, I never did this and I never did that. And I never went through divorces because I'd never been married. But, you know, I can guarantee you if I had been married, I would have had lots of divorces. So, yeah, so it was so easy for me to sit there and look at the differences and not the similarities. So I read this and it says, for most people, the word alcoholic is a deadly term conjuring up images of weak-willed skid row type people unable to hold a job or any type they're proud not to be. Their image of the alcoholic is different from how they see themselves, that they have a good excuse to go on drinking. Every member of AA understands this type of thinking because almost every member once entertained the very same thoughts. They've learned that denying there's a problem is the part of the disease of alcoholism. And then it says, from the beginning, AA members have regarded alcoholism as an illness, a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. We've all heard that, right? So this says, it's important to understand that alcoholism is not determined by where you drink, when you started drinking, how long you've been drinking, with whom you drink, what, or even how much. The true test is in the answer to this question. What has alcohol done to you? If it has affected your relationships with your family, check. Your relationships with your friends, check. Your employers, if it has affected your health, if it determines or affects your non-drinking moods or your state of mind, if you are in any way preoccupied with alcohol, if you have little control over when you take a drink, or once you have a drink, you have little control over how much you drink, then the likelihood is that you have a problem. Mind blown. When I read that, I was mind blown that it pretty much quantifies, like, it takes all the excuses out for you. You know, it doesn't matter what type of alcohol you drank or what time of day you drank or who you drank with or what other substances you did. If it affects any part of your life, pretty much. You know, for me, it affected my work. It affected my family. My family was really worried about me. I mean, my mom started going to church and praying for me because she, you know, just didn't see any hope. And my health, I was having, when I came in to the program, I was having kidney issues, and I wasn't even 30 yet. And I just was in such denial, you know, and it absolutely affected my non-drinking mood. I could not be in a room full of people without having alcohol. I was so uncomfortable and so lonely and so sad all the time that I just needed to have alcohol to just escape. So for me, that was an important step of just recognizing, you know, what has it done to me? You know, there wasn't anything good that alcohol had given me. It was fun at the beginning. You know, at the beginning, I started drinking in high school, and it was fun, you know, to go to parties. But, I mean, the experimentation started right away. It was one of those, like, what's on the table? What are we doing tonight? Let's, like, get going. And I just couldn't wait to have as much in my body as possible. I love the effect that was produced by alcohol. I loved it. I love, like, you know, the first time I ever got the spins and laying, you know, getting home after a party and being like, oh, my gosh, I never want this to end. And I felt taller. If you guys know, I'm 5'1". So I felt taller and I felt more beautiful and I felt, you know, smarter and all these things that I wish I had. And then I remember going to school, you know, the next week and just feeling like a completely different person and feeling different and alone. And even though I have lots of friends, I always was alone in the middle of the room, surrounded by lots of people. And that just followed me. Like, it followed me all the way, even in early sobriety. You know, I just, when I removed the alcohol from my body, I was just uncomfortable. And I had to learn through sobriety how to love myself and how to be me and how to embrace those things about me. So, yeah, drinking started early. I grew up in Visalia, and then I decided that my ticket out of Visalia was going to be to get into college. So even though I did my drinking and my partying, I made sure, like, I always got good grades. I was a chameleon, like, living two separate lives probably since I was really little. There was the part that looked good, right? The, like, let's get good grades and, like, let's be likable. And then the part in my room, like, inside with me, that was just, like I've talked about, the loneliness. So I got good grades. I got into UC Irvine, Bill's alma mater as well. Go Anteaters. Yeah, the Anteaters were the mascot. How weird is that? And then they did this. It was like zot, zot, zot. That was like their tongue. And that was the Anteater. Anyways, so that's down in Irvine in Orange County area. And so I went down there 18 years old and living in the dorms and start, you know, gaining weight from all the food and, like, the late night. And so I decided I need to start taking diet pills. And so I started taking Xenadrin, and that's the stuff that's illegal now. It became illegal, like, shortly after because it was pretty much legal speed. So got addicted to these diet pills, staying up all night, partying, like, it was just a whirlwind, you know, like away 300 miles, 200 miles away from home, no family to check on me. It was a fun time for a while. I mean, I'm not going to lie, it was fun. There were lots of consequences and lots of stuff to be ashamed of, but, you know, it was relatively manageable for a while. Decided to join a sorority because those are people that drink just like me, you know, like keg parties, all of that. Who else wants to get alcohol in their body as fast as possible? So did all that. It kind of around my, I'm going to tell you the only way I those diet pills pretty much got me my education. I'm just going to say, like, you know, it just being honest, I started going on, like, a really dark path, and alcohol was always my companion. Ended up graduating and got into real estate down in Orange County, and it was at that time before the big market burst, and there was a lot of those, like, shady subprime loan mortgage guys And those were my best friends. And so we were young and we were making lots of money and we were going to clubs and I would go out to a happy hour and all of a sudden I'm in Las Vegas, you know, and we're just partying it up. I never knew what was going to happen. Drinking was like Russian roulette for me. I didn't know where it was going to take me and I was down for whatever. I mean, one time I found myself in Mexico with people I didn't even know. I had gone to a bar. I went to have some drinks with my bartender friend, and then some people were like, hey, we're going to Rosarito, do you want to go? And I was like, absolutely. So I went home to my apartment, told my roommate, and I'm packing a bag, like, if you don't see me come back, these are the people I'm with. Like, something in me knew that this was not a good idea, and yet, once I started drinking, I didn't care what consequences there were. Like, I was just chasing that fun. Ended up in Mexico, made it back, thankfully. I didn't even remember the people I went with. Like, went to a bar maybe like a month later and they're like, oh my God, we have such a great time with you in Mexico. Didn't even know. Couldn't have picked them out on the street. I was just doing stuff like that all the time, getting kicked out of concerts. I had a wig that I would put on. So when I got kicked out of a bar, I'd go home, put on my wig. It was a blonde wig with bangs and, you know, change my outfit and show up and just get back into the bar. It was just this cycle of, like, people liked being friends with me because they never knew what was going to happen. Like, what crazy shenanigan. But again, like, I would always take it to that next level. You know, got to the point where I would be home alone, you know, after the night would end, and I would be up awake with everything I had left to put in my body, and I would be in tears because I absolutely did not want to drink this rest of this alcohol. I absolutely did not want to put this stuff in my body, but I could not once it was in front of me. Like, it just, that disease of more just overcame. It was an obsession. It was an absolute obsession. Even trying to throw down the, you know, the toilet, pick up the phone and call in somebody 5 minutes later, like, I just could not. It had these handcuffs on me. So I did that I was down in Southern California for about 10 years. I kept pretty good jobs. My last job, that was just a recipe for disaster. Like, it was a real estate company, and they had a beer pong table on the patio, and there was a restaurant with a bar in the building, and it just was like, there's no way I was going to stay sober working there. And one day, they called me in and said, you know, we're going to give you, they pretty much paid me to go away. And it took me into doing my step work. I was like, I was let go because I was given a severance. I was paid money. And my sponsor was like, you were fired. You were let go. You were fired. And so I was like, okay, humility, right? So I got fired. And then I found myself living in a really expensive place with not any money and an addiction. And I ended up going to therapy because I thought therapy was my issue. And she was like, sweetie, you need AA. I was like, I don't need AA. She's like, you need to go get the AA book. So I thought, I was like, where the hell am I going to get the AA book? So I went to Borders and I bought the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made sure to get the, like, small one with the dark blue cover so you couldn't read. It wasn't the big one that said Alcoholics Anonymous because I was so embarrassed to, you know, get it. And I go home and I start reading it. I'm like, what the heck is this? This doesn't make any sense. Like, you're trying to read Bill's story and you're trying to read the doctor's opinion and it doesn't make any sense. And I find out later the big book is a textbook. It's a textbook. It's meant to go through with a sponsor, someone who is showing you how to interpret this book. People who are new, what I did, and I also suggest other people to do, is before you get a sponsor, start reading the stories in the back of the book. That's a good way to identify and see if you may be an alcoholic, if you identify with anything back there. But for me personally, I needed to go through the first 164 pages with somebody else. And I got so much more out of it when I did. So I was trying to read the book on my therapist's direction, and that wasn't working. And she was really worried about me. she actually was my first unofficial sponsor because she was really trying to, like, instill those principles of, like, well, what's your side of the street? And let's look what your part is. And, you know, how's that working for you? And so I kind of, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and actually started working the program, some of the concepts were familiar already because she'd already kind of planted those seeds, which is such a blessing. So she tried to get me into AA, and that didn't work. My family, they tried to get me into AA, and I just, like this pamphlet said, you know, I thought it was the Skid Row type, you know, the type of alcoholic in a paper bag and a trench coat and that stereotype. I didn't think that a girl in her 20s who just, like, binge drank daily was an alcoholic. So my family ends up convincing me to move back to Visalia. And so I moved in with my mom. You know, at the time, there's a lot of family drama going on. Like, my parents were getting divorced. My grandpa had a heart attack. So I thought I was coming home to, like, save the family. Like, I'm going to come make everything better. And I move in with my mom. She's like, absolutely no alcohol, no drinking. I'm like, well, that's, you know, that sucks. But I had no job, living with my mom. Decided to go to therapy because things were still really bad. Went to see another therapist, and she's like, you need to go to AA. Like, you are overreacting. So I literally went to therapist number three. And number three, like, she was great because she was like, here's an AA meeting. I think she had me call long-haired Rick. I think it was long-haired Rick. And she said, call this guy and ask him for a women's meeting. And so I ended up, let me think. I didn't know the women's meeting wasn't the first meeting. It was the Sunday Serenity Seekers in the morning. I remember Ken being there. The morning meeting when it was at, it wasn't the Blue Room, but it was at the Quia Delta Multipurpose Center, I think, on Essequia. And, like, I walk in and everybody's happy. I think I expected everyone to be like, oh, great, my life is over, I'm in AA. Like, we're all, and everyone was laughing, you guys were eating cake, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, I was like, cake and coffee, it's amazing. They asked if there were any newcomers. I didn't say anything. But after the meeting, I did see those chips that people got, and I was too shy and nervous to get one. So this woman I was sitting next to, I think it was Barbara. She was the barber that used to work at the Holiday Inn. Barbara T, I think. She walked me up, and she said, this young lady needs a 24-hour chip. And I remember getting that chip, and I was really excited. You know, I was kind of like, what does this mean? She gave me her phone number, gave me a list of phone numbers. And I didn't have any plans to go back. You know, just, and if I didn't have a plan to go back, you know, what reason was there? So I did hear, if you think you could do some controlled drinking, go to the nearest bar room. So I did try to do that. I did. I had a trip up to San Francisco where I had my last drunk, went to visit some friends. We had wine and, you know, lots of cocktails. And I found myself getting sick all night long. And those seeds have been planted. You know, my friends go to bed and it's midnight and we still have vodka left. What am I going to do? You know, I'm going to keep drinking. I'm an alcoholic. That's what I do. So I keep drinking. I drink all night long by myself while other people are sleeping. And I'm getting sick in the morning. I'm just getting sick because alcohol does not want to stay in my body anymore. And I had that moment of clarity. I looked in the mirror and there was makeup all over my face. And I heard God say, like, when are you going to stop doing this to yourself? And I was like, what? Like, he helped me to realize, like, I was choosing this. I was putting this alcohol in my body. No one was forcing me to drink all night long. No one was forcing me to drink to the point where alcohol wanted to escape my body. I was choosing to do this. And so I drove from San Francisco back to Visalia, and I pulled over and I cried. Because in the back of my mind, I was like, well, maybe I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I should see what these meetings are about. Maybe. Like, I got a little bit, like, open-minded about it. So I drove home. I think, you know, I just probably cried for like a week. Just like trying to get the courage to go to a meeting. I ended up going to a women's meeting. It was a Saturday morning women's meeting. And I walk in and I end up sitting next to this woman who's my sponsor now. You know, I believe it was God intervening right then. A phone list came around, and I looked at the woman who had the most amount of time, and it happened to be Catherine, and Catherine was sitting right next to me. And so I asked for her phone number and asked if we could go to coffee, and because I was like, I don't know what this is about. I wanted to talk to somebody one-on-one to just, I'm a very informational gatherer person. I like to gather all the information before I make any decisions. And so my meeting with her is supposed to be a fact-finding mission. And when I went in, or when we met, God kind of told me, like, you need to be honest with this woman. You need, because I was having some health issues, and she's like, you need to be honest with, you know, everything that's going on. And
so, how do you go from San Francisco to Visalia with being drunk all night and nothing else involved?
Oh, I was hungover.
Oh, hungover. Who can drive?
I don't know. Lots of coffee. So, Catherine, I said, okay, is she gonna, you know, I need to be honest with this woman. And I was. And she stood up and she gave me a hug and she said, that's why God brought you to me. And I just, and she was crying and I was crying because my story was very similar to her story. And, at the time, she had like 10 sponsees, and she had promised them that she wouldn't take on any more sponsees. But I had shown her that I was like desperate, and she is one to not turn anyone away. And turns out, like, it's just me and someone else who are still sober. You know, a couple of the girls have actually passed away. And so Catherine from day one has been my sponsor, and she was on a walker, and she loves, like, hearing me tell a story that she told me she needed rides to meetings, but she didn't need rides to meetings because she knew everybody in the program. She just wanted me to take her to meetings so that she could reel me in and, like, start getting people to, like, introducing me to people. So I started going to meetings. I did the 90 and 90. I go to Bridge Street a lot, the noon meetings at Bridge Street. I do probably a couple meetings a day just because I wasn't working. I didn't have any friends anymore. I was living at my mom's, so I just wanted to get out of my house. So I do Bridge Street at noon or Alano Club, and then I'd usually do an evening meeting. But in Bridge Street, I don't know, I got a lot more vulnerable at Bridge Street, I think because it was just a smaller meeting. And JC,
this is not a shared meeting. It's just a hosted meeting.
I don't.
Yeah, we generally don't interrupt the speaker while she's sharing.
Thanks, Bill. I'm just confused about these questions. Let me think. What was I saying? So. JC used to always come up to me because I'd be crying about something, and he'd be like, thy will, not mine, be done. I'm like, what does that even mean? And it was like, it wasn't until I got in the book that I needed to really start being like God-centered and like whatever his will is instead of me like trying to control the outcome of everything. So, you know, I'm going to Bridge Street and I'm doing my steps, and life is, I mean, it's getting better because I'm not drinking, but, like, things are still happening. Like, my grandpa had a heart attack in front of me, and I was asked to be, like, in 5 weddings. Like, how am I going to go to a wedding sober? Like, that was ridiculous. I was so stressed out. I was like, why would you do this to me? Why would you ask me to be in a wedding now that I'm sober? I had, like, 2 or 3 weddings within my first year in sobriety, and every time I did, like, my I'd go to a meeting. I'd tell people how nervous I was. They'd have their cell phones ready. You know, I'd know, like, I'd have a plan. My sponsor was like, anytime you're going to go into a situation where there's alcohol and you feel uncomfortable, put together a plan. What are you going to do when you start feeling uncomfortable? She said, number one, try to be of service. You know, if someone needs pictures taken or the bride needs, like, her dress fixed, like, go and do that. Stay busy. Just stay, you know, just occupy yourself however you can. And I did that. You know, I was like, hey, I can do it. What do you need done? Like, let me do something so that I don't have to sit here and watch people drink, like, all the time. And it was funny because the wedding that I was in was at the country club. And at the time, one of our members, Rick Evans, was the manager of the country club. And so he employed a lot of sober people there as servers and bussers. And so I was like, crap, I can't relapse, because then the whole AA community is going to see me relapse at this wedding. And I just feel like God did that for me also to let me know, like, I wasn't alone. Like, yeah, I was at this event for people who are drinking, but there are also a lot of other people in the community who are sober and able to stay sober through these events. And that was important to me. And I remember getting home that night and, like, washing my face, you know, girls, we get our makeup done and everything. And that was the first time I'd ever gotten home from an event and been sober and, like, done that stuff sober. And it was like, wow, you know, and I felt amazing going to bed that night sober. And waking up in the morning, I was so proud of myself, like, so proud that I got through that, because it was so hard. So that was, like, things like that would, you know, happen early on in sobriety. I had some health issues early on in sobriety, and it was hard to walk through it. And, like, going to Stanford and having procedures and, like, just, you know, just emotional stuff. And what else? What I learned was, and I feel like God needed to show me within a short amount of time, all of these things that I could get through and stay sober. Like, I didn't need to drink out of all this. You know, and in sobriety, like, a lot of stuff has happened, like breakups. Breakups are freaking ridiculous to get through in sobriety. You know, they're so hard. And, deaths, you know, my grandpa passed away a couple of years ago, and that was rough. But the cool thing about that was when I was brand new, we have a member, Rayanne, a lot of you guys know who she is, and her mom was passing away, and she would tell me the stories about how she would go to the hospital and spend time with her mom and how she got to be there for her mom when she was passing. She got to be there. So when this happened with my grandpa, I was reminded that I get to do this. I get to be here with him. I got to hold his hand and be there when he passed. And it was a beautiful experience because Blythe, you know, 10 years before that would have run away and pretend like it didn't happen, get as drunk as possible and just not deal, like, anything to escape my emotions. And I got to have this beautiful experience, and he loved not feeling alone. And it was probably one of the highlights of my life, really. So I was so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for teaching me how to do that. And then, I mean, I'll just share, like, something I'm going through right now. Shortly after that, my mom and I had a falling out. And so she hasn't spoken to me in 2.5 years. It's been 2 years. And it's been painful. Really, really painful. Mother's Day was a couple of weeks ago, and it was probably the hardest day that I've had in a long time. And that's just me not working stuff out, you know? Like, I've done the steps. I've written about it. I've talked to my sponsor. I think that I'm going through the motions, but there's something else I need to do to level up, you know? And it's probably going to take some other kind of program to like, dive deep into that. Because, you know, even at 10 years of sobriety, like, it's still work, you know? And it's still, there's still, you know, we don't have all the tools. Like, I have as many tools as I do, but there's a lot of, you know, maybe I need to meet somebody else in another recovery program that will show me how to walk through these feelings. So that's my next adventure here in Sacramento is probably looking at adult children of alcoholics or something like that. So yeah, that's going on right now. I live in Sacramento. I love it. I met a man in this program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're building a life together. And it's a really great journey. You know, it's a lot of fun. And I'm in real estate now. So I'm back into real estate. I took a little break because when I was getting sober, real estate was not a good idea to be around the alcohol and entertaining. And so now I'm back in real estate and I love it. You know, I'm on a new career path, which is exciting. I'm excited to build a fellowship here in Sacramento. You know, I've met a couple of women that I really like. You know, and that's been a grieving process too. You know, a lot of my friends are from Visalia, and my AA community is from Visalia. And, yeah, so it's just a lot of change, but it's good things. You know, and I couldn't imagine doing life without Alcoholics Anonymous. It literally saved my life. And, I just wouldn't be the person I am today without it. Like, I actually enjoy my own company. I don't need to have music or something on all the time to occupy my thoughts so I don't think about, like, you know, me and all the crappy things I'd done. Like, I used to wake up late at night with, like, all these stories spinning in my head about, you're a shitty person because you did this. You did this. Like, taking my own inventory and going down those dark streets in my head. And now it's like, yeah, I did shitty things, but I'm not a shitty person. I was a sick person. I'm a sick person, and I'm recovering, and I will always be recovering from Alcoholics Anonymous, or recovering from alcohol. For me, that's what I choose to say, is I'm recovering, because I know myself, and I know when I'm recovered is when I stop doing the work. So for me, I'm continuously recovering. I love this journey. I love the relationship I have with God today. I love that He's there for me unconditionally. That was the biggest lesson I learned, was it's not this blanket God. He's my God. And he's, you know, he's there just for me anytime I need him. And that was really comforting. So yeah, I'm just really happy to be here. I love seeing all the familiar faces. I've missed you guys so much. And I know we're a little early, 7:45. But I don't have much else to. What? What are you saying, Bill?
Leah's going to ask you some questions.
Oh, yay. All right.
I am. So, is there anybody who has any questions out there? Bill. Looks like Bill has a question.
I got a question. Bill.
Okay.
I got a question. Hey, I'm an alcoholic, Bill Eisman, and Blythe, thanks so much for coming and being in service tonight. Here's my question. What has changed? You seem to be really comfortable and in your element, and everything's cool tonight, but I remember a time when you really didn't want to do this. And I'm just curious, what changed?
You know, it's funny, because Bill had asked me to speak at the Valley Groove Food Group meeting for 5 years, and I wouldn't do it until I had 5 years sober. Absolutely not. And he would say, I thought that you're supposed to take suggestions. Isn't that part of the problem, the part of the program? I was like, and I had talked to Catherine about this, and I just was not comfortable. I'm a normally very private person, you know, and I think that speaking my truth, and like, I was fine in small settings, but just like a big auditorium with microphones just really freaked me out. And I think I had to get to a level of comfort with myself, right? Like, I wasn't, even 5 years into sobriety, I wasn't comfortable with myself. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. And I can't even tell you like what it took to get there. I think it was just a lot of step work, a lot of just exploring like me and learning to like love myself. And I think it's just, you know, surrounding myself who like gave me that, unconditional love, like, right. They loved me until I could love myself, and like learning how to have an intimate relationship. And like, intimate isn't you know, sexual, I've learned. Intimate is sitting at a coffee table with somebody and talking about your deepest, darkest secrets and sharing your vulnerabilities and being honest and compassionate. And I think once I started really developing those kind of relationships, I was able to be more free, you know, and I think it just came with, for me, like getting older in general. Like, not that like I'm so old, but you just kind of get to the point of like, who cares what other people think, right? And at the beginning, you know, we do care what people think, you know, and that whole like, what is it that my sponsor used to say? Like, what is it? Like, what other people think of you is none of your business? No, I thought that was ridiculous because of course it's my business. Like, it's about me. And she was like, no, you can't control it. You cannot control what other people think of you. Therefore, it is none of your business. It should not occupy any time. Once that concept clicked, it was like, okay, well, I just be me, like unapologetically. And that's kind of how it happened. It evolves.
Awesome. Thank you. And I have a question for you, actually.
Okay.
So, being that we are all stubborn, as we all are, very stubborn in our own ways, what was your, what was the biggest, like, stubborn, the thing that you were stubborn on the most, and how did you overcome it?
Like a character defect?
Yeah.
That
one that would stick and just lingers and,
yeah.
You know.
See, that's the thing is, I know that in the book it talks about those things that people aren't willing to give up, but I feel like I was ready to just do whatever. I didn't have anything, my biggest thing was I was intolerant, but I didn't know I was being intolerant. I thought that if I had an opinion about something, like, I should say it, like, I need to be honest, and really, it's like I had to learn that concept, like, doesn't need to be said by me. Doesn't need to be said by me right now. That was a huge lesson that I had to learn because timing is everything. You know, like, we can still be heard just picking the right time, especially for your partners and your loved ones. Like, that is a huge lesson that I've learned. Also, the idea of the hula hoop, like, if it's not in my hula hoop, it's not my business. Like, you stay in here, what can you control? You can control Blythe and your emotions within this hula hoop. If it's out there, like I said, like, it's none of your business. And that was big for me, because I don't know if it was like I needed to feel in control. Like, if I was in control of a situation, I would feel better and feel calm. But I can't control everything. Like, I just have to, like, lean on God and just, like, have God get me through whatever situation I'm going through. So I think that's my biggest, like, struggle that I had.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Hi, Blythe. This is Matt. How you doing?
Hey, Matt.
Good to see you, dear. I had a question about your fellowship there in Sacramento. What form is that taking? Are you a part of a women's group? Do you have a book study? What's your AA? What form did it take for you there? Because we know how Looney Tunes we are here. Is it like that? Is it larger, smaller, tighter? Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah. So fellowship, they have fellowships. So if you're familiar with how they do things in Fresno, they have different fellowships. Like, they'll have Fresno Fellowship, and like at Fresno Fellowship, it's a meeting hall, and they'll have meetings like every day at 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 12, 2, you know, like, so it'd be kind of like if Christ Lutheran had a fellowship, you know, and there were meetings at Christ Lutheran or Bridge Street. Bridge Street's like a fellowship. Alano Club's like a fellowship. So that's how things are here, is there fellowships. Some of the fellowships are starting to open up. They've been on Zoom a lot. So I do have a women's meeting I found on Zoom that I love. I love these women. They're just like the women here. And they're young. They're about my age, and they have like 20 years of sobriety. They have a long time of sobriety. So I can't wait to meet them They are going to start opening up in July. So I'll get to go to that meeting in July and meet some other girls my age. But that's one of the things that I struggled with moving here, was that I had this picture of, like, I'm going to move and I'm going to find a sponsorship family and find girlfriends. And then it was like COVID. It was like stuck in the house and Zoom and struggling with, you know, building relationships over Zoom. But, yeah, things are going to open up. One thing I did notice that they do is some of the places don't do birthday meetings like us. Like, the end of the month, we'll have a cake for everybody in the month. And here, they just do, like, your sponsor will walk up and give you your chip and say something about you. So, like, if I was celebrating, Catherine would go up and say, I'm presenting Blythe her chip. She'd say something for a couple minutes, and then I'd walk up and get my chip, and I'd say something for a couple minutes. So there's not a birthday table, which I like the birthday table, but I'm partial because that's what I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous doing, right?
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. It's great to see you again.
You too.
Thank you, guys. And our friend here, Gabriel, wanted you to know that he loved what you said about being an alcoholic. It isn't about what you drink and how much. It's about how it affected your health.
Yeah. So. That was a game changer for me, for sure, is taking away those. We all come from different backgrounds, right? We're all different and have different experiences. Yet, if you listen to our stories, they're all very similar. You know, they're very much the same. Like, a lot of us felt alone. A lot of us needed alcohol to mask our feelings or to deal with things. Or we drank when we were happy and we drank when we were sad. And, you know, that's what I love about the program is, we have this bond that other people don't have. And I think it's really cool and really special. Like, I would choose having dinner or coffee with an alcoholic any day versus a coworker. I would be so uncomfortable with a coworker, a normal person, but I would have dinner or coffee with probably anybody on this Zoom meeting and find more in common with you guys than somebody else. And to me, that's comforting because the things that we've gone through are rough, you know, like defying death. Rough, you know, like we've been down to the pits of hell and like we're back. And so I think that if we can sit and connect in that way, it's such a beautiful thing because we're all really similar. If you take away those personalities, right, and just like look at the core, we're all we're very similar.
Thank you, Blythe, so much for your the very, very awesome, very good, I connected with that a lot. So we have come to the end of our speaker portion of our meeting. Round of applause, Blythe.